Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Henry III Roundtable. I'm Darren Baker, together with historians John Marshall, Michael Ray, and Hugh Ridgway. We've been on hiatus for about the last 5 months or the end of summer. So we're starting off a new year, you might say a new season, and we're going for broke. We're going to start off right with the big controversy of Henry's late reign, namely the Sicilian business. Anyone who knows anything about Henry could probably tell you, well, there's Westminster Abbey, there's Simon de Montfort, and there's the Sicilian business. Usually it appears something like a paragraph, and it says, well, here's this King of England who engages in this great folly of thinking he's going to put his young son on the throne of Sicily. It turned out to be much more complicated than that. It's conceivable that whole books could be written about one episode of Henry's reign. Probably one of the best, just to get a general idea of it, is the Sicilian Vespers, a classic by Steve Runciman. And he basically goes over all the issues that led up to this point. But his basic idea is to get to the Vespers with Charles of Anjou. So while he more or less brings in all the factors that affect Henry and his reign, he doesn't really go into any great detail on them. And that's what we're going to do here today. So anyone with not so much knowledge about why Sicily was so important at that time, we have John Marshall with us, and he's going to give us kind of an overview of what happened, or what was the history of Sicily. From John, I think you're going to start from the Norman invasion around there, or?
Yeah, I think it's probably a good place to start. I think it's probably worthwhile just starting off by saying that at this point, the time that we're talking, that Sicily is not very Italian. It had been a Greek colony. It had fought with the Phoenicians. Then the Arab, the Muslims had come, and basically you have probably a Greco-Arabic Sicily in the 13th century in Henry's time. It's not very Italian. More Italian as you get into the mainland. One of the things that we know, of course, is that Sicily is attached to what is effectively the toe and the boot of Italy, known as the Regno in Italy, which is more Italian, but Sicily itself, very Greco-Arabic. We have then the coming of the Normans. Those Normans get around. In fact, what's interesting there is that the Normans get involved in Sicily and slightly ahead of them getting involved in England, which is interesting because we have a very Anglo-centric view of the Normans. What happens is that a pope with an anti-pope, which is also interesting, with a wonderful name, Anacletus, decides that he wants to get rid of the Muslims from Sicily, and he's going to use a bunch of Normans to do that. That's the Hauteville family, and he offers the kingdom to the Hautevilles if they can conquer it, and lo and behold, they do. And so we have the beginning of a Norman dynasty. No great Norman migration to Sicily. Basically, they're just a ruling family above these Greeks and Arabs.
Weren't they more or less invited to the peninsula first? Didn't the Pope wanted to get rid of the Byzantines?
They were, yeah. And he wanted, they got involved. There were Saracens in southern Italy too. And so it's very much a case of trying to basically, it's almost not like a crusade, but basically get rid of these Arabs from the south
and
of Italy.
And Byzantines, right?
Yeah.
The Greeks there, yeah.
The Byzantines, they basically were still, the Greeks were still in Sicily, but they'd lost control of it to the Arabs a couple of centuries earlier.
Okay.
So going back, so we have this Hauteville dynasty that takes over, and you have this wonderful melange. It's often talked about in some ways as a golden era in Sicily, that you have this Hauteville family ruling Sicily. Also, various parts of as we said earlier, the toe and the heel. In fact, one of them, William II, if we're cycling forward into the 12th century, actually marries Henry III's aunt. And so one thing we just need to be aware then is that certainly as far as Henry is concerned, this is not a, what to quote Chamberlain, a faraway place of which we know little. Sicily, his aunt Joan, who dies before Henry's born, but she is the queen of Sicily. She is married to William II, the wonderfully named William the Good, as opposed to William the Bad.
That was his father, right?
Yeah, so you have, you with the Hautevilles, you begin with Roger I, who isn't king of Sicily. You then get Roger II, who is made king of Sicily. You then come to William the Bad, William the Good, and then they start to run out of Hautevilles. And that's where we start to hit a problem, because it's the daughter, Constance, who is married to the Holy Roman Emperor at that point, who is Henry IV, who is a Hohenstaufen. And of course, that starts ringing alarm bells with the papacy, because we have a situation there where the Hohenstaufens are ruling the empire north of the Papal States, and now they're getting their hands into the south of the Papal States, into Sicily.
Sorry, Henry, not Henry VI, was that?
No, well, sorry, I've got here, it depends on the numbers that you call me, Henry IV of Sicily.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Henry IV of Sicily, yeah, the regnal numbers, depends on whether you count him as the emperor or as the king of Sicily. So he's never actually in Sicily very much, but his son, who is born to Constance down in the south of Italy, of course, is known to one and all as Stupamundi, Frederick II, the much excommunicated Frederick II. He is emperor, he is king of Sicily, he's literally either side of the Papal States, and this, of course, is very much a problem for the papacy. We also then have Pope looking back to this point that he's granted, that even though it was an anti-pope that had granted the kingdom of Sicily, the Pope is still thinking, well, I've granted this kingdom, it's a fief of mine. So I'm going, what I gave, I can take away. And so he begins, even in Frederick's time, to start to look at ways to take away the kingdom from the Hohenstaufens.
Well, perhaps one
thing you should mention is that Frederick II actually married Henry III's sister.
Yes.
And so, you know, again, it was not an island that no one knew nothing about. Richard III was there on his way to the Crusade.
Yep. And
senior clerics had served the Kingdom of Sicily before this. One of them was Archbishop Messina, another one was more or less their Chancellor. So we'd had lots of connections with Sicily before this business.
But I think when the Normans, when they moved south from Calabria and into Sicily, and they conquered it, I think it took a couple of years, but I believe that it was sort of an agreement with the papacy that the Pope will crown Roger as King of Sicily on the understanding that it is a papal fief. I think this creates the whole problem, because then Henry IV of Sicily, or Henry VI, the emperor, well, actually, before him, his father, Frederick Barbarossa, had his eyes on Sicily even before that time. But he ended up getting washed away in a river in Asia Minor. So, but then, you know, something that people don't realize about our Henry III and the Sicilian business is basically he's trying to get back what good English money bought. Because it was Richard the Lionheart's captivity on his way home from Crusade, and his ransom that he had to pay, 150,000 marks thereabout. I think Henry VI, the emperor, used that money for the army that he marched down into Sicily to take full control of the island. So, you know, we can thank Richard the Lionheart for.
I think we need to, really, as Michael said, we just need to really underline that, is that Henry's aunt and Henry's sister had both been Queen of Sicily. So that's, it's not It's not like most of the other kingdoms in Europe. It's not like he wanted to suddenly become king of Portugal or even king of Cyprus or something, you know, or even Holy, you know. It's basically a kingdom which the family has had interest in on a number of occasions.
So now Henry the Sixth, the emperor, he dies kind of suddenly at the end of the 12th century, and I believe Frederick was maybe four or 5 years old, and he was made a ward of the Pope because it was considered a papal fief, and so because he was so young. I believe it was Henry's younger brother, Philip of Swabia. He was given the crown. He was made king of the Romans by the Pope. I can't remember the circumstances why, but this put him in opposition to Otto, the brother-in-law of Richard the Lionheart, who was basically a member of the English royal family, because Otto of Brunswick was raised at Henry II's court. So, and he.
Otto was the ally of King John, wasn't he?
Right,
And
yeah, he.
if he won the Battle of Bouvines for John,
Right.
English would have been totally different.
Oh, completely, yeah. But I think Richard the Lionheart or Henry, one of them, I remember reading in Roger of Howden how he was made Earl of York, but I never quite understood. I don't know if Otto was actually Earl of York, but he did go back to Germany, and he was made Holy Roman Emperor by Innocent III at the time of launching the Albigensian Crusade. And I believe, again, I don't know if my memory is all there correct, but that Innocent was very eager to draw in German contingents into this crusade, which would happen later on, but not at the beginning. And then, as Michael says, you know, Otto threw his weight behind John against Philip II of France. There was Bouvines, and of course, and because Otto lost that battle, he also lost the crown, the empire, and I believe. Yeah, it was Innocent's successor, Honorius, who bestowed the dignity of emperor on Frederick. And the understanding was that the king of Germany, or the king of the Romans, and the king of Sicily would be completely different people. They could not be combined in the same person. And Frederick II, he had absolutely no intentions of allowing that to happen. But well, as we know, his eldest son, Henry, he was Henry VII, I suppose, as King of the Romans. He and Frederick just fell out continuously because Henry VII was the King of Germany. He was in Germany. Frederick was in Sicily, or Calabria, Apulia, and Frederick kept overriding him, or he was allowing the Italian northern cities too much freedom, so forth. Anyway, at the end of that story, Henry dies in prison under some.
Frederick, of course, was also the most successful crusader.
Yeah, he got Jerusalem back.
Well,
Although he's
all
absolutely
right, but he.
different.
Yeah, he got it back by default, basically. But yeah, you're right, he got it back.
I think actually we talk about Frederick, but one of the things that we probably just need to think about with him is he's a Holy Roman Emperor, but he's an Italian. He's of a German family, but he's more of a Federico than he is a Friedrich. Which is, from the perspective of where we're going to go with this, that's worth just bearing that in mind. He was born south of Naples, and he lived most of his life south of Naples. Expeditions north of the Alps, Darren, but he generally pretty much always thought Sicily was home.
And he's buried in Palermo.
Well,
Yeah.
that's true, but he ended up in this quagmire of northern Italy, and that was basically where he fell out with Pope Gregory, that, you know, Frederick demanded the homage of these cities, and they were just too independent for him. And as we know, after Isabella, Henry's sister Isabella, marries Frederick, Henry tries to give him a wedding gift in the form of 100 knights to fight for Frederick against Brescia. Maybe Simon de Montfort was part of that
So the
contingent.
king, Henry's uncles at this point, it's just worth also mentioning, and Hugh was asking about the Savoyards earlier, is that they're kind of caught as the ham in the sandwich, because they have the emperor which to be loyal to, and they have the papacy to be loyal to. One is to their south, one is to their north, and they control the access from one to the other.
Yes, and of course, they spent most of their time playing the one off against the other, didn't they, to the benefit of the House of Savoy? I mean, you know, since 1244, Philip of Savoy, who was Archbishop Elect of Lyon, had been hosting the refugee Innocent the Fourth, and at exactly, well, more or less exactly the same time. Thomas of Savoy had been made an imperial vicar in Piedmont, and so he was sort of, as it were, heading the imperial cause in the north of Italy. So, you know, it's a classic example of the balancing of those Savoyard forces. Very, very important for the Savoyard lands, wasn't it, as you say?
It
And they
was. It
controlled
was.
the mountain passes in between the two.
And that's where you have that very clever enfeeffment of those castles to Henry, which is, of course, they're worried about the imperial army coming across the Alps. And of course, that gives them the opportunity to say, well, you need to ask Henry for passage, not from us. But
Right.
they're
Yes.
kind of
Yes.
caught in that
Yes.
political middle
Yes.
between the two, trying to keep the emperor happy, trying to keep the pope happy.
But to my mind, the Sicilian business all starts in the Great Revolution, which actually happens in a way all of a flash, really, in 1250. Now, in 1250, a variety of important things happen. First of all, Frederick II dies and leaves a sort of power, well, the prospect, anyway, of change, political change. Secondly, the Savoyards ditch imperial camp and join the papal camp. Also, it's in 1250 that Louis the Ninth was captured, and this creates a huge flurry of worry in Western Christendom. And as a response to this, Henry III took the cross.
Well, he took the cross before news of Louis's defeat reached England.
Well, whether he did or not, you know,
No,
it
he
was in
did. He
1250, the whole thing happened. And what I'm trying to say is that at exactly the same time, all these sort of things start, these juices start to run together. And you cannot, from that point onwards, disentangle the crusading ambitions of Henry III from Sicily, because ultimately he gets involved in that, and also, of course, the role of the House of Savoy, because they basically sort of become shock troops, you know, the diplomatic agent of the papacy, and their great sort of advances of the sort of papal cause,
Sure. I mean,
and you know,
it was the Savoyards
all of
who.
them, you know, Archbishop Boniface of Savoy spends a huge amount of time in the Roman Curia, and you know, Savoyard diplomats, they're at the very heart of all the that goes on really in the 1250s.
I mean, it's unimaginable that Louis would offer Henry the service of 500 knights for 2 years without Savoyard involvement. Just, you know, it just would not have
Oh
happened.
yes, it's a very, very
But
yes, a
to
very,
get,
very interesting sort of aspect of the Treaty of Paris, yes.
yeah, but not to get too far ahead of ourselves. So let's go back to again to the defeat of at the Battle of Bouvines in 1214, because this set off the chain of events, as we know, King John, Magna Carta, and also John making England a papal fief. So now you have you come to the year 1215, 1216, and Pope Innocent, he's got it in his mind. This is Innocent III. He's going to launch a third crusade. Now, his first two crusades, the fourth, a complete disaster. The Albigensian crusade, a complete disaster. But he's going to launch even a third one. And he has to have in mind the fact that Sicily, the Kingdom of Sicily, is a papal fief, and now England is. So he's got these two kingdoms basically not just paying him tribute, but basically who should be listening to his commands, so to speak. And of course, he dies quite suddenly, as does King John, and then everything starts, and Frederick is made imperial, or receives the imperial crown. So this takes things in a different direction, even though there is a fifth crusade. But my point is John's early death or untimely death, this puts Henry on the throne. As we know, the papacy through the legate, Gwalla, is absolutely instrumental in defeating the French forces and the rebellious English barons. Henry is secure on the throne, but the papacy wants its rewards. So their legates are basically installing Italians in these benefices throughout England, as probably they're doing also in Sicily and so forth. And this, combined with the politicization of the bishops like Stephen Langton and so forth, this is creating what becomes a powder keg for Henry, that you have this anger lurking under the surface of all these English churchmen towards the papacy, all this money going there, all this these orders, do this, do that. And so finally, when it comes 20 years later to the actual Sicilian business, and it looks like a partnership between the King of England and the Holy See, then that's one of the reasons why this opposition explodes in Henry's face in the late 1250s. Because without the Church of or the Churchmen of England, Simon de Montfort would not have made even half the progress he did in his opposition. So anyway, let's keep that in mind. England is a papal fief at this time, just as Sicily is. So yeah, you.
I the only thing I was going to say was two things. First of all, of course, yes, I think these were big themes, but the church wasn't exactly united over all these things, and some bishops were more ultramontane than others, and so on. And the other thing I was wanted to say was, it's very interesting, isn't it, that Henry didn't take the cross until 1250, and he's getting on a bit by that stage. I think possibly Henry might well have felt a bit embarrassed by the fact that he hadn't actually taken the
Well,
cross until
well, in
1250.
fact,
This great pious ruler,
he had taken the cross after he was after his coronation, his first coronation. So officially, he was an avowed crusader. But you're right; he was just born then.
And I think that of course, it's typical of Henry really that he'd be a bit late in the day, sort of jumping, as it were, on the crusading bandwagon. But
Well,
it did become then, I think, a sort of an aspect, let's put it like this, in the in this sort of, if you like, friendly rivalry between the Angevins and the Capetians. Of course, the Capetians had this great crusading reputation, and of course sealed by Louis the Ninth. Whereas I suppose the Angevins felt that they had to sort of, as it were, keep up with the Joneses and be seen to do things. I mean, crusades were of course getting very, very expensive, and of course there were two sorts of crusades. There were the sort of people going off in dribs and drabs to the crusades, and then there was sort of serious crusading, which involved major armies. It was very, very expensive business. And by the 30, well, even by the time of the Third Crusade, well, the Second and Third Crusades, the papacy weren't really interested in individual crusaders. They wanted kings to go on crusades, because only kings really could achieve any sort of real change in the course of warfare. And I think that that was became an important sort of aspect, really crucial aspect of crusading, the relationship between kings and the papacy. And I think on the whole, generally speaking, papacy tending to work towards the reinforcement of royal authority from that point onwards. I mean, you know, notice the sort of weak attitude of the papacy towards Becket, murder by Henry II. You know, they really rather wanted the sort of Angevin's on side. So they always had that in mind. You know, kings were the only people who could sort of achieve crusades. And crusades, of course, were very, very central to the papal sort of mission, weren't they? It's a very sort of,
Central, yeah.
yes.
You may remember Michael Clancy wrote the piece called "Had Henry III a Policy?" And of course, David Carpenter countered it by showing how from 1250, Henry III made very serious attempts to build up a store of money. He started
Yes.
collecting gold throughout
Yes.
the country, and
Yes.
he got to well over £3,000 in the end.
Yes.
Wasn't enough, of course, to do this
Yes.
sort of thing, but it showed
Well,
he could be concerted
yes.
effort to do this
Yeah. And
program.
I agree with you. And this raises the essential question of how much did a crusade cost?
Well,
You know,
but
the
look at
crusade that
this.
really could do some good. And the answer to that is, I think the figures are something like between 60 and £100,000.
But
Now, the
Lord
actual revenues,
Edward spent more than that on his crusade.
well,
He had just
you know, as I say, the Lord Edward's Crusade, where he was actually voted money by Parliament in
and
1272. Yes,
after
the
also.
total sums of money voted were about 60,000, and that was able to provide an English force which was able to do some good, but it wasn't in the end sort of overwhelmingly successful. But you
Some
know, you're
good.
talking mega money along those sort of signs, you see.
Certainly a lot
You
of
have
money,
to be
yeah.
a major big hitter in Europe to raise a serious crusading army which can actually do any good to
Really and
sort of.
truly, there isn't a successful crusade of any sort almost after Richard and Philip August. And there you needed a King of England and a King of France acting in
Exactly, to work
concert.
together, really. Yes,
Yeah.
yes,
Yeah, and
yes.
all
I
they did
agree with you.
was basically seize Acre again. You know, that's they didn't
Yeah.
get Jerusalem.
But
So,
you may remember when the Pope first offered Sicily crown to Charles of Anjou before he offered it to Edmund.
yeah.
He was going to give him £50,000 and £50,000 later on. So
Yes,
this is
that's
what
crusading sort of level money, isn't it?
offering
Well,
the
yeah,
money
I
and
mean,
later on
I,
demanding money.
you
Now,
know,
you've also got to remember, you've got to ask yourself, right, in all this, what is the average annual income of an English king? By this period, well, by the 1250s, it had dropped to just slightly, wasn't it?
about
James
25
Collingwood
to
showed this,
30,000.
about sort of
Yeah.
just under 30,000
Yeah.
pounds per annum.
Which is about half the Kingdom of France, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So you've got to, you know, if any king of England wants to go on crusade, he's going to have to majorly sort of jack up his income.
But he was expecting the church to pay for much of this.
Well, exactly. I
Oh,
think
yeah.
what you did was you the church raised a certain amount of money and you matched it by secular taxation, didn't you? I think that's the way it really worked, wasn't it?
Well,
Yeah.
something that you're talking about, you know, being able to finance a crusade or raise the money, and the fact that Henry was building up this gold treasure. When you think about the 1250s, when he had the Gascon problem, he's saving up for his crusade, all this running together and building Westminster Abbey, it kind of reminds me of the 1960s and Lyndon Johnson trying to do
Yes.
fly a man to the moon,
Well,
Vietnam, the Great Society, and somehow it all works.
exactly. Henry III, if you David Carpenter calculates that the total cost of Westminster Abbey was £40,000. That's over a period between 1245 and 1272, and that Westminster Abbey was costing him about £2,000 per annum. But as I say, it's an it's it all sort of is a drain, you know. So one of the things that Henry would have to decide, wouldn't he, if he was really going on crusade, was to what extent was he going to backpedal on expenditure on Westminster Abbey in order to go on crusade or do anything involving a major military campaign. So, you know, all these would be, if he's got any common sense with finance, would have to be you know, vital issues. Now, the other thing that they have to decide is who's going to actually be in charge of the army, who was going to be the capitaneus of the English forces. And that was always a big thing, a big problem with Henry, because, of course, Henry had never really seriously led an army in battle. So you'd have to have somebody to be the captaineus of the English force. Now, of course, the obvious person you might say for that was.
Simon de Montfort.
Oh, exactly. Yes, Simon de Montfort. Now, this very interesting thing. Henry takes the cross in 1250, and in April 1253, Henry III promised Peter of Savoy 10,000 marks for accompanying him to the Holy Land. Now, I wonder whether this was a sort of suggestion that Peter of Savoy was going to be fingered as Henry III's captaineus for
That's who I was thinking was going to be it, not Montfort, but
crusade.
it was always going to be Peter of Savoy.
Yes. This is a very interesting point. And you wonder what would Simon de Montfort think at that
Yeah,
point?
and Simon de Montfort thinks, oh, Henry is putting me in Gascony, this thankless job here, and Peter of Savoy is going to reap all the benefits of the
Yes.
crusade, you know.
And Peter, of course, took the cross, but of course Peter was also very much behind that rapprochement with Paris that leads to the France that leads to the Treaty of Paris. A prerequisite of a crusade would have
Yes.
to be the
Peace.
nullification of the Anjou
Yes.
incapation
Yes.
problem.
Well, you needed two things. First of all, you needed peace with France, and then you also needed the pacification of Gascony as well. And of course, the Savoyards were intimately involved with all those projects, including, I hasten to add, that the pacification of Gascony via a deal with the King of Castile as well. You do, I mean, you know, because the problem with the Castilian marriage was that Henry was had made a pre-contract, hadn't he, with
Up in
Alfonso the
Africa,
Tenth's mother, was it? Like, or this wife, actually. So technically, Henry was technically still married. Well, was pledged
Oh
to.
yeah,
No,
you're
there
talking
was a
about Joan of
problem with this
Ponthieu.
marriage.
But I think
And
Henry's
anyway,
big.
but. In 12, as I think I'm right in saying, Savoy diplomats were working to nullify that pre-contract as early as 1249.
Oh. Yeah,
And that.
but it really I think that whole thing was initiated by the marriage plans for Edward, which
Yes,
started
it
in the
was.
late.
Yes, but don't you see, Darren, that's crucial for the security of Gascony,
Well, okay, it is, but I think
that
Henry's bigger
marriage with
problem.
Alfonso.
Well,
With Alfonso's daughter, rather.
Henry's bigger problem with Alfonso is that he's committed to a crusade in North Africa, which
Yes, I know, but I'm but and but the bigger picture, as far as the Savoyards were concerned, was, I'm sure, the security of Gascony. Now, as you all know, that one of the big things that the Savoyard faction at court were really interested in was the well-being, let's put it like this, of the affairs of the Lord Edward, very dear to Henry III's wife, and of course I suppose Edmund as well, because her household was very much again, whatever household Edmund had was very much sort of dominated by the Queen's sort of people, and so I think that their whole that's what I said earlier on. I think that the whole sort of, if you like, crusading Sicilian projects were seen as a great whole by the Savoyard faction at court.
Absolutely.
It was all seen as something, you know, perhaps Henry's crusading ambition could be seen as a means of encouraging peace with France, and also perhaps the Crusade could somehow, in other words, all this sort of thing could help towards the pacification of Gascony. And all this then, of course, would be to the furtherance of their sort of, if you like, protege, the affairs of the Lord Edward.
Certainly, and the sort of thing there, of course, for Edmund is it's part. Yeah, we see Edmund and Edward together. It's part of that whole Savoyard project, as Hugh was saying. It's and which, of course, the end of that is the protection of Eleanor's position in London. The raison d'être for all of those Savoyard uncles in
Yes,
England
absolutely.
was Eleanor. And therefore, how do you protect Eleanor? Well, you protect Edward and Edmund. So yeah, so we should see it in that context.
Now, in 1258, if they persuaded de Montfort to back the Sicilian business because of his connections with crusading, you already mentioned his family are actually still in the Holy Land, people there. Would it have been successful? A known leader, a man who wasn't a Savoyard, etc., or would they still have thought this was once again another alien problem, and de Montfort would have lost the backing of people because he was backing an alien cause?
We're back here with our discussion on Henry III and the Sicilian business. And Michael brought up a very good point. What if Simon de Montfort had been enticed to lead Henry's crusade in 1258 thereabouts, thereby changing his direction towards the upcoming reform period? I personally believe that relations between Simon and Henry had completely broken down by that point, so that if anything, Simon's just going to have his revenge on Henry however he can get it. And we might go all the way back to 1248 when Henry and the Queen are more or less begging Simon to go down to Gascony, be the lieutenant down there, bring order down there again. And it's interesting that they sign or they seal a 7-year contract. So Simon is going to be the seneschal for 7 years down there. That would take him to the summer of 1255, which would be just almost 1 year before Henry is supposed to launch his crusade in the summer of 1256. So maybe there was this enticement that Simon would lead Henry's crusade at that time. But of course, the situation in Gascony went out, spiraled out of control just after Henry took the crown, or maybe a year after thereabouts. And so, as Hugh mentioned, here we have Henry offering Peter of Savoy, what was it, 10,000 marks if he would go with him to Gascony. So it kind of seems like that Henry has already decided that Peter is going to run the crusade, that Simon had his chance in Gascony and he blew it, more or less. So.
Well, yes, Henry, of course, Michael pointed out, was sincere in his crusading in terms of trying to raise revenue. Of course, David Carpenter's long shown about the gold fund that Henry had amassed, and I think it's very interesting that David was reckoning that Henry was saving gold at about 6,300 marks per annum, and basically by 1256 he would have amassed, had there not been a problem, about 47 and a half 47,500 marks, which would have matched the sum of the crusading tax authorized by the Pope that would have been raised from ecclesiastical taxation of about exactly the same amount. So that would have amounted to something like 90,000 marks, i.e. about £60,000, which is an interesting figure because, of course, that was exactly the sort of sum that was behind Lord Edward's crusade later on. Which, you know, as I said, goes back to my original point about the sort of enormous cost of crusading. But it did show that Henry was sincere about this. But unfortunately, of course, events, dear boy, got in the way. And of course, Henry must, in some respects, of course, have blamed Montfort for that.
Well, yeah. I mean, we can argue whether all the castles he was building or whether the high-handed tactics he was using contributed to the security or not. But you can see poor Henry, you know, he's got this gold treasure, a mess he's going to print here or stamp his beautiful coin to take with him, you know. And it all just comes, it's basically by 1257 when this first idea of enacting reforms with a council at hand, that it's looking more and more like his crusade is well, it's definitely on hold. So, but you know, there's all this idea that reforms were forced on Henry, and I disagree there. I think he sees it as his only way of getting his tax from the laity. As one thing, but also just that all crusaders put their houses in order before they go on crusade.
Well, as Louis the Ninth had, yes,
Yeah,
yes, yes.
and we look at the example of Louis. Now, Louis took the cross after his deadly illness in 1244, same year as Jerusalem was lost to for good, it turns out. And he threw his heart and soul into it, even though his mother Blanche was like, oh, you know, he was going for full throttle. And the thing is, again, you put your house in order. So he sends these friars. He does his inquiries more or less, you know, to provide justice throughout his realm, which incidentally Henry tried to take advantage of by saying, okay, you want to give everybody justice? Give me Normandy back. So Louis has undertaken this idea to put his house in order. And he gets back all of this information showing just how much injustice exists in France, but he has to go now. He's running late. So he's basically going to go on crusade and he'll put his house in order when he gets back. Well, his crusade ends in disaster. So when he comes back in 1254, the first thing he does is enact reforms. Because he wants to try and crusade again, you know, this time to have success. And I think Henry has learned a lot from his example. He's like, okay, you know, I mean, everybody, let's say a lot of historians see Henry looking at Louis as a great giver of justice, and oh, if only I could aspire to be that. I don't think Henry's doing that at all. I think because both are very pious individuals, Henry is saying, okay, Louis didn't get his house in order, his crusade ended in disaster. I'm not going to do that. So I think he's more or less welcoming 1258 and the chance to undertake these reforms. I don't care what the Tewkesbury analyst says about a march on Westminster. So anyway, that's my view on
There is another Savoyard scheme which we probably need to just bring in at this point, Darren, which is when Frederick dies, his two children, one legitimate, one illegitimate. The legitimate Conrad takes over in Sicily, but the illegitimate Manfred is the Prince of Taranto, and the Savoyards marry the daughter of Amadei IV, the Count, to the aforesaid Manfred, and it is dangled that Manfred and Beatrice become a resuscitated kingdom of Burgundy. So Thomas, of course, becomes very interested at this point, and so that, again, going back to his comital family, they have ideas at that point, just after the death of Frederick, that they're going to suddenly find themselves with an interest in a resuscitated kingdom of Burgundy.
Right, and so Thomas was Count of Flanders. Joanna died 1244, and then he married the niece, right, of the Pope. Yeah,
The Pope's niece, yes,
and this happened before 1250.
1250.
Wasn't he already trying to get his foot into that camp?
Yep. And he's so the foot the Savoyards have been trying to get themselves power into northern Italy for some time. They've been reaching down the Susa Valley and down the Aosta Valley and coming up against the city states in northern Italy, of course. So yeah, this was all part of that plot.
Yes, and of course, I think it was Frederick II had promised Thomas of Savoy pretty much Turin, hadn't he? I think. So that had been part and parcel of his becoming imperial vicar, wasn't it?
Well,
Yeah.
this is what I find frustrating about David's biography of Henry, that he looks on Henry's subsidies to Thomas as a complete waste of money. And when he writes about Thomas's death in 1259, he says, oh, what a dance he did around the king, as if Thomas was just this sort of salesman, just, you know, more or less taking money from Henry and giving no return. But Thomas was obviously a very influential player in Europe. Everybody was trying to court his favor. So
yep.
He must have had something somewhere.
He was obviously thought to be sort of a politician and commander of some talent, I think.
And he was the oldest, right, John? Wasn't he the oldest of the surviving brothers?
He was older than most of them. Yeah, I think Amadei was still, when Amadei was alive. Amadei died about this point. So yeah, so up until Amadei's death, after Amadei's death, yeah, certainly.
But Amadei never left Savoy, right? He just
no, he just stayed in the hills, pulling the strings, huh?
Yes. Now I think it is fair to say that. Of course, I think all the evidence does suggest that, in theory, Henry was committed to crusade, and he never commuted his crusading vow to Sicily, even though he had the opportunity to do that, because he had the opportunity in May 1255.
Alexander did it for him, whether he wanted to. I think Alexander made it official, didn't he?
It was in May 1255 that Alexander IV empowered the Archbishop of Canterbury and Master Rustand to commute Henry's crusader vow to Sicily. But Henry didn't take up that offer. And of course, Henry then remained committed to the crusade and was still collecting gold for it in the period down to 1258 and thereafter. But the big question, I suppose, arises is that, you know, why did Henry accept the offer of the throne of Sicily to his son Edmund, if he was committed to crusade? Secondly, what was in all this for the Savoyards, who were very, very keen on the whole?
Your first question, I think, is basically it goes to the question of Gascony, because we have this creation of the appanage for Edward that takes everything Henry has. He has absolutely nothing to give Edmund. And I'm kind of wondering if Henry buying out the heirs to the Earldom of Chester, if not Chester had been meant for Edmund, he would be the Earl of Chester or something to that effect. So, and also by making Edmund the designate king of Sicily, that more or less increased his marriage value on the market. I think they had some offers from Cyprus, you know, like, hey, and of course, I don't think Eleanor of Provence would have been too happy
yes.
to lose Edmund.
I
like
totally
that.
Agree with you that, because many years ago, I wrote an article, which I was reasonably still proud of, about Henry's patronage problems. And of course, his problems with Simon de Montfort and nearly everybody really stem from the fact that he didn't have enough patronage to cope with all the demands on him. And of course, there you are. There's another aspect of it. You know, what could he give Edmund? He wasn't the sort of king who could actually sort of destroy an earl and sort of confiscate his earldom and give it to his ex-second son. You know, so what you say? What could he give Edmund? And he was sort of, and of course, the Queen had maneuvered all against all these sort of options. I mean, there's rich again, she'd sort of made all the attempts to prevent Henry granting Gascony and Chester to Richard of Cornwall. That had all been earmarked for Edward. And Ireland, of course, was you couldn't sort of trespass on Edward's lordship of Ireland.
Well, yeah, the Lusignans tried that, and we see how that
Exactly.
happened.
And
And certain.
there was nowhere else to go, really.
Yeah.
I think also in this period, the Sicilian deal or business was a kind of stunt by the Savoyards also, of course, to counteract the impact of the Lusignans that had already arrived in Henry's court. Because, of course, again, as you know, as early as 1252, the Lusignan and Savoyard factions had clashed. And of course, certainly trouble in Gascony would increase the importance of the Lusignans, who in fact provided 200 knights for Henry's campaign in Gascony. And you know, obviously their lobbying factor would increase all the more. And so I wonder to what extent the this Sicilian project sort of attempt this is an attempt to counteract that by capturing the king's imagination that something could then be given to Edmund. And
Yeah,
so
it
that was
certainly
the sort of fascination, I think, of the whole thing.
certainly Hugh, if you could get Sicily, it was very rich. It was a
Yes.
very, very rich source of income if you could get it.
Yeah, but there's also when Innocent the Fourth dies, this is right at the time when Manfred defeated the papal armies at Foggia, and so everything is looking bad from that prospect. Then Alexander the Fourth becomes Pope. He's a very weak individual, can't make up his mind about anything, but he's stuck with this policy. But if they had some competent generals down there, maybe things would have turned around. And I have to think that after the defeat, I can't remember the name, 1255, but anyway, it was another papal defeat. And already Alexander was pushing these harsher terms on Henry. I have to wonder if not Henry, then at least the advisors around him were saying, okay, we have to, step back a little here. But what changes is 1256 and the death of William of Holland, and this frees up the king of the Romans, and Richard of Cornwall, Henry's brother, is eager for this title. And I can imagine that Henry, being who he is, the idea that he is the king of England, Richard's going to be the king of the Romans, and Edmund's going to be the king of Sicily. We're going to have three Angevin kings in Christian Europe. I can just see his eyes, stars in his eyes, because
That
he.
would certainly have little. I think, though, you mentioned Manfred's defeat of the Pope at Foggia. I think we can mark the decline of the Savoyard interest in the whole Sicilian business to that battle. As
Well,
soon as
yeah,
Manfred,
and this
as soon as
battle.
Manfred, yeah, as soon as Manfred gets that throne, they have Beatrice de Savoie is the Queen of Sicily.
Yeah,
So.
but yeah, John, you're a bit too far ahead there, because Manfred still needed a lot of consolidation, but it did happen just, I think, 1 or 2 months before Thomas of Savoy got captured in Asti.
Yeah,
So I
it
think those two events coinciding
well,
sort of
yeah.
helped
If
him
I
out.
could just sort of perhaps go back to a big point that David Carpenter raises, and there is you know, there are two really major problems with the Sicilian candidature. Of course, one of which is that Henry was never offered any money by the papacy.
The
And
second,
he's
the
never offered
Alexander.
the
Oh,
ecclesiastical profit, you know, the profits of ecclesiastical tax or anything like that.
sorry, Hugh, but Innocent the Fourth did offer Henry 25,000 in the original deal, but Alexander nixed
The
it
deal got
in
worse.
the second one.
Hang on a minute.
Alexander's deal was certainly much more Carthaginian, yes.
Yeah, Alexander offered no money, and he wanted the debts clear. But this really wasn't Alexander. He had those holdovers from Innocent, and also Alexander was so weak he couldn't even create cardinals. He couldn't decide who's going to be a cardinal. So he just sort of blustered his way through till
Yes.
death
Yeah.
in
Well,
1261.
David Carpenter says that the papacy, of course, wouldn't really grant Henry sufficient funds for Sicily because they didn't really think that Henry was worth it because of his well, relatively weak military record. You know, they didn't think really Henry was a
That's
warlike.
just David and his view of Henry. Everything
Well, I
that
think
happened to Henry is
it,
detail.
You see, and then if you take that view, then of course, then Sicily was a sort of kind of a bargaining chip of some sort, really designed to sort of keep.
Exactly. Really, you're right there, Hugh. If you have Sicily, you th this sort of more or less expands your portfolio around the whole Christian world. But here's a question I would like to ask everyone. Let's say Sicily is offered to Richard the Lionheart or to Henry II or Henry I. Would they have said no?
Yeah, but well, yeah, but they were in a totally different position from Henry the Third, weren't they? You know,
I
you've got
understand that.
the
That's
Angevins
right.
have got were very, very much sort of they've got huge
Yeah, they hadn't
realms
lost
and
Normandy,
so
had they? Yeah,
on. Yeah.
but just this idea that you're being offered this rich kingdom. I mean, who would
Well,
say
yes, but I know, but you have to sort of have the money and the
no?
military know-how in order to get it.
Yeah,
No.
but Hugh,
The thing is
you
that there
have
was
the
never
lower
really.
side. Henry feeds all these poor people. He builds all these churches. The Lord is on his side. There's going to be a happy ending
Well,
sooner or later.
I do think that in Henry's case, there is a bit of a sort of delusion, really, that lies at the heart of all this. I mean, especially, of course, I have to say, with the. The second grant of or the second offer of Sicily in 1255, when really the terms were so unfriendly,
Onerous.
let's put it like this, to Henry. By that stage, it's really quite hard to see how Henry would be able to achieve this. Given all the sort of signs which were not sort of too propitious by that stage. I mean, I think it would have made sense had he pulled out, I think.
Do you think he
You
could
see,
have pulled out?
the
Could he
thing
have
was, you see,
pulled out?
the big thing, the big crunch Parliament, as you know, was the early one in was the run of April 1258. And in order to sort of bankroll the whole scenario, you needed a tax the equivalent of Richard the Lionheart's ransom tax, £100,000, which was an unprecedented level of taxation, which would have required a huge amount of political sort of concession and so on. And it's that really which put Henry's kingship on the line, and I don't think really, Henry had avoided these kind of political showdowns quite effectively, but now he just couldn't, and I think that this is where things did start to look rather sort of bad. I mean, you have. I mean, even by that stage, you've got a pretty sort of obvious rejection of the Sicilian project, haven't you?
First of all, can Henry even pull out, with respect to his relationship with the papacy, even with his own subjects, this would, of course, would be considered an automatic default failure, if you like. That's one aspect of it. But also, as we all know, Henry's not making these decisions alone. He's definitely taking counsel with people. What is the best way to go? And there is also just the hope that the more offerings you make to the saints and the shrines that the happy ending will more or less come. And I mean, it's really not Henry's, let's say, fault or insight that Alexander just proved to be such a hopeless pope. And then after his death, Urban was not even much better about it. But the reality is that when Charles of Anjou eventually conquers Sicily, it more or less proves that it was not an impossible task.
No, but I would say but his situation was quite different. I mean, he was given the revenues of the kingdom of the ecclesia of the church in France to bankroll that campaign. I think that
I
really
know
the
you, but
political
then this,
opposition of the English aristocracy really,
we it,
Henry, having reaped the benefits. I think the Treaty of Paris was a huge benefit, the pacification of Gascony, huge benefit. Of Henry's reign and fitted in very well with what he was capable of achieving. But I think really Sicily was a step too far.
But if you think that he, okay, let's say the reforms stay on course, because it's my view that it was Simon de Montfort in the autumn of 1258 who scuttled the whole thing. He deliberately went out to sabotage it. But anyway, let's say the Treaty of Paris takes effect in 1258, as it should have. Henry gets the money for the 500 knights. It forms a core of an army. Louis is going to give him passage now. So it was not inconceivable that this project could have happened. It's just my view that Simon de Montfort ruined everything. So, but maybe that's something we can pick up the next time.
Yes.
I'm
Anyway, it's been
supposed.
nice to see you all now. I've got to
Nice to
go.
see you again.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Darren.
All
Thank
right.
you.
Great. So, guys,
Happy
I'll be
travel.
in touch
Thank
about
you.
the next time, and we'll take up from there. All right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Have a
Thank you.
good
Bye
one,
bye. Bye
everybody.
bye.
Enjoy. Bye.